Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Marek Laskiewicz, Chairman of POSC, it is my privilege and pleasure to greet you to POSC, which is the largest Polish centre outside Poland, and indeed probably one of the largest community centres in the world. We have many cultural events here, of which today's is an excellent example. And I would like to say that, of course, I do hope not only to see you today, but see you on other occasions in the future. Szanowni Państwo, jako prezes POSC-u, witam wszystkich tutaj i mamy nadzieję, że dzisiaj event nie jest oczywiście bardzo ważny, ale też zobaczymy Wam, Państwu, innym razem też. So, it is my great privilege and honor to be here to present Count Nikolai Tolstoy, whose book Stalin's Vengeance he will now present. Count Nikolai Tolstoy.
Can I sit down?
Please feel free.
I think I'll.
You're at home here.
Sit down. Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very grateful to Marek for organizing everything and my good friend Basia for organizing a lot. And, my book, as you probably have seen, is about the repatriation of the Cossacks at the end of the war. Many people may straight away think, well, haven't you written other books about this? Well, I have. This is the third book. The first was Victims of Yalta, came out in 1978. That was about the whole repatriation, not just Cossacks, but altogether the Allies, Western Allies, mainly the British and Americans, handed over about 2.25 million former Soviet citizens and others, Polish, Baltic, Romanian, who shouldn't have gone, of course, who were caught up in this. And it was a colossal, as it turned out, war crime by any standards. And we're constantly being told to feel guilty, as we should. I didn't say we should feel guilty, but we should be sympathetic to the ghastly sufferings of people involved in the slave trade several centuries ago. But this was a slave trade on a very comparable scale, 2.25 million people handed over to what, well, must have been one of the very worst slave conditions to which slaves could be condemned ever existing in the world. Stalin deliberately worked people to death. He wanted to get rid of them. He didn't have quite the same incentive as slave drivers in the West Indies had, for example. Not that this usually worked, but they had nevertheless a realistic motive of keeping the slaves alive to go on working. But it's not a popular story, and as I've discovered in this country, well, it may be popular, I think there's more people on our side than on the other, but the people on the other side have power and influence. I'm Russian, most people here are probably Polish, I see some Russian friends. But we have a lot in common. Of course, our countries have been at war for many years. But we're on the same side as regards communism and as regards military aggression of any sort. The first I ever heard about the forced repatriation was in 1956, and I was vividly reminded of it because we've just been to a carol service in the Brompton Oratory. And it was there that I must have known some Polish people before that, but I was quite young. And we were all, the reason I went there was because I was invited by Polish friends, because we were all enraged. It was 1956, and Bulganin and Khrushchev had been invited as the first Soviet statesman to come to England. And I remember going to the oratory and meeting many Polish people who, of course, were outraged. Not the least sinister part of it was that the Soviet government sent in advance to make sure that everything was in good order. Ivan Serov, who was the butcher of the NKVD, as the KGB was then, who went into the Baltic states in 1940 and arranged mass deportations, murders, killings, and the rest of the unfortunate people in the Baltic states who were then forced to become part of the Soviet Union. But as far as the forced repatriation is concerned, the Poles come into it in a very considerable way. For example, not many people are aware that the very first book published on the handover of the Cossacks is this one by Józef Mackiewicz, published in 1957. There was nothing known about it. It wasn't even talked about. By coincidence, it was actually at that very time that I learned about what had happened, but at a very remote. And I was so angry at the reading about Bulganin and Khrushchev coming, and I was living with my parents in South Kensington, and I heard they were arriving at Victoria Station the next morning. So a Polish friend had given me a big poster which said, "Keep the red beasts out." So I took my poster and I went to Victoria Station. And there I saw, I was close as that light to Bulganin, Khrushchev and Eden, who kissed them on the cheeks. And I held up my poster. There were the only other people there, there were no protesters except me, was about 30 British communists that existed in those days who were holding up copies of the Daily Worker, which said, "Welcome, comrades." Well, I thought, that's not going to be the only message you get. So up went my "Keep the red beasts out." The next moment, someone jumped up and tore it out of my hands. I was really angry. I was only 19. I turned around, and there were three thuggish-looking people who were tearing it up, and they suddenly grabbed me. I hit one of them. I was quite pugnacious in those days. And they seized me and took me away into a dark corner, and it turned out that they weren't, as I thought, communists, but the British Railway Police. And this was the first time I came in confrontation with the British establishment in some degree. They kept me, and then until the Bulganin and Khrushchev had gone away, then they took me in a Black Mariah to a police station, and I was locked up there for the evening. Anyway, a nice police sergeant came in to give me some bacon and eggs, and we got into conversation, and he said, "Why are you so upset?" People in England then had no idea, really, about what the menace of the Soviet Union. And I said, well, I tried to explain, and I think someone must have told me, because I said, and there was this business of handing over thousands of people back to be murdered or enslaved by Stalin. And the sergeant said, "Oh, that's funny you should say that, because 10 years ago I was in the army and we were stationed in Austria. And we had to send these Russians back on the trains. And we couldn't understand it. They were throwing themselves out of the carriages and purposely landing on their heads to break their necks. And we just wanted to get back to England. We couldn't understand why they didn't want to go back to their own country." And that was how the first person I heard about that from. But the first time I became thought of writing a book about it was not till some years later. Well, it wasn't very easy to think of writing a book. Where would you get the material from? And then in 19, books did appear. There was a very good book by American called Julius Epstein, who wrote a very good book. I think it came out in the early 60s. But he could only rely on what was published at that time, which was really awfully little. And he focused also on the Americans. He was very brave there, because it wasn't really done in those days to be critical of the Soviet Union. Then came a much more important book by a man called Peter Huxley Blythe. His book was published in the States. It didn't make much of a splash. I think it was a small publisher. But it's still a very useful book. I knew him when he's dead now, because the book relied... He'd been very enterprising. He was quite a young man and interviewed a number of the Cossacks who'd escaped being handed over and got down their stories. And so, insofar as those testimonies, the people who gave him the testimonies died long ago, that's preserved them. And the next book which came out before my one did was by Lord Bethell, Nicholas Bethell, called The Last Secret. And I was rereading it. It also remains very useful. And again, in his case, he interviewed not only some Cossacks, but also, for the first time, British officers and soldiers who were involved. And I was at that time already myself planning to write a book on the subject. And I was dismayed, I remember, because I found out, I think, through my publisher. I got a contract from publisher. Then we found out that Nicholas Bethell was not only writing a book, but had almost finished it. And like all authors, I was dismayed, because I thought, well, there'd be no room for my book. But when his book came out, very shortly after this, I read it, and it's very good because of the testimony, but he had no access to what was going on. He could describe what happened, but he couldn't describe why it happened. And indeed, it led him into minor errors, for example, as I shall explain shortly. One of the most, or possibly the most sinister aspect of the Cossack repatriation was the inclusion of several hundred or thousand, we don't know the exact figure, of people who were not Soviet citizens at all. They were people like my father, or even myself. My father was born in Moscow, but I was born in England. It didn't matter if you were caught up. It didn't happen in England, luckily, but if you were caught up there, they were handed over as well. And I think that's what led me to burrow and burrow until I think in this book I have finally got as near to the truth, as far as you can get to it, to the complete truth, you can't, but as near as you can, because I was very concerned about this aspect. Nicholas Bethel, of course, he was English, he had no reason to be especially concerned about the White Russians, and indeed, I was glancing at his book yesterday, he does actually almost say that the White Russians were perfectly legal to hand them over. He didn't defend it, he thought it was a bad policy altogether. But I would, having been brought up in the White Russian immigration, I've been very influenced too by a big historical novel written by the former ataman of the Don Cossacks, General Peter Krasnov, who was an able writer. I wouldn't perhaps say a great writer, but certainly an able one. And he wrote a large number of books between the wars when he was living in emigration, first in France and then in Germany. And he wrote, the most famous one was a massive book called From Double Eagle to Red Flag, and it's largely based on his own experiences. And it's about what happened to a Russian cavalry officer during the revolution and shortly afterwards. And it's still very readable. But from my point of view, it imprinted on my mind. I knew who he was, and I admired his book, and I'd read others of his books. And I thought, well, this is something very fishy. I mean, how could he possibly be handed back? The Yalta Agreement, signed in February 1945 in the Crimea, which provided, it was concerned with other things, of course, but the big three, Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin, met. And on the last day, there was the rest of the meeting was public and known to, was open to newspapers to report. On the last day, they had a secret meeting, which was about the mutual return of British and American prisoners of war liberated by the Red Army, and correspondingly Red Army troops captured by the Germans, or whoever they were, they weren't necessarily captured, because there were several million Russians swilling around in Europe as a result of the war. Many of them prisoners of war. Of course, vast numbers of the prisoners of war had died in atrocious conditions in German camps. But I think about a million, probably a million and a half, were still alive, just about. Then there were simple refugees who took the opportunity of fleeing from Stalin's Russia. And to them, of course, they were men, ignorant people, certainly ignorant of affairs in the outside world. Everyone in the Soviet Union was ignorant of that. They thought the Wehrmacht, were coming as liberators. And in many cases, they did. There were many decent people in the Wehrmacht who felt very strongly that we should be going to war with communism and not with the Russian people. And even very senior German generals pursued very liberal policies in occupied territory, opening churches, schools, and so on, publishing newspapers. So the Germans were, to some extent, popular, and it says, Solzhenitsyn says, it says something for the Soviet regime that they actually preferred the Nazi regime, or at least what they understood the Nazi regime to be. And then there were simple refugees who, as the Red Army advanced, fled from the fighting in general. But the Yalta Agreement on the return of, as far as concerns the handover of Soviet citizens to the, it says that they shall be repatriated as soon as it's convenient and possible, and the same with the British and Americans, the other way around. It says nothing about use of force at all. Now, that was only a later interpretation of it, which both the British initially, under Eden's influence, and the Americans at first were quite firm. The State Department said this does not allow us to hand back people who are reluctant to go. Obviously, people who want to go back to Russia can go and we'll help them, but they shouldn't be forced. And also, it was pointed out by the Secretary of State at the time that the that to hand back captured Russians serving in the German army, of whom there were astonishingly about a million, as Solzhenitsyn said, wrote, in the whole history of warfare in mankind, has there ever been such a gigantic defection of a country's own citizens willing to fight against them? They'd put on German uniform, and that meant that they were in the German army. They were protected by the 1929 Convention on prisoners of war, of treatment of prisoners of war, which, but the Soviet Union, needless to say, had not signed the agreement. But nevertheless, in international law, it applied, and it certainly applied to the British and Americans. And for that reason, the British, Americans, French too, of course, and the other countries fighting against the Nazis, that they were protected by the terms of the convention, and indeed it worked. For the most part, Western Allied prisoners were often, well, they're often treated harshly, but not utterly cruelly as the poor Soviet prisoners of war were treated. But anyway, if you were serving in the German army, wearing German uniform, carrying a German identity card and so on, you are, under international law, a member, they were members of the German army. And that would be a grotesque violation of the Geneva Convention to hand them over to be tortured, murdered, or enslaved by another country. And for a while, the Americans stood out against that. But then they came round to the British viewpoint. Nevertheless, none of this, of course, affected people who were not Soviet citizens at all. The Yalta Agreement explicitly says Soviet nationals, never uses any other, never says Russians, for example, which could be misinterpreted. So this, to my mind, presented a very strange picture. Well, how come that Krasnov, and as I came to learn, and Nicholas Bethel points out, that hundreds, if not thousands, of white Russians in Austria, among the Cossacks, and they were the only ones to whom this happened, were handed over against their will, and also that extreme violence was used, which is not provided for in the Yalta Agreement, and it would be entirely contrary anyway to international law going back long before the Geneva Convention. Well, what happened on the ground is, I've still found fresh evidence because now, since 1990, people have been free to publish their memoirs in Russia, so very valuable memoirs have come out there. I found out much more about it. What happened was that during the war, a large number of Cossacks who had been very harshly treated by the Soviet regime joined the German army. And they were joined, too, by white Russian emigres from Paris, Belgrade, Berlin, and so on, who, as they were, for the most part, officers in the Imperial Army, experienced soldiers, they were taken by the Germans to be officers of the Cossacks. But when as Germany began to crumble at the beginning of 1945, the Cossacks were removed from anywhere near. They didn't fight on the Russian front at all. They were taken. Hitler didn't trust them. He said a Russian will never really fight against another Russian. So the Cossacks were transported to North Italy, which was the last bit of occupied Europe outside Germany and Austria. And then as the Allies moved forward up the Italian peninsula, they retreated and eventually moved back over the frontier into Austria. But on the very day, May the 8th, of the German surrender, the Cossack sent a deputation to the advancing British troops and said, we'd like to surrender to you. The British soldiers, officers said, yes, right, we accept your surrender. And they withdrew back into Austria, and there at the little town of Lienz, which is a place of pilgrimage for many Russians, Cossacks and others, they were for 3 weeks set up camp in former German barracks or in tents, whatever they had. And there they lived on very amicable relations. They were fed and looked after by the British. And initially, the British had no reason to think that they would be maltreated in any way. But during that time, the orders arrived that the Cossacks were to be handed over, all of them. And on the 29th of May, the Cossack officers were summoned and told they were to go to a conference where they would meet Field Marshal Alexander, the supreme Allied commander in the Mediterranean, which included Italy and British-occupied Austria. And he would discuss with them where they could settle somewhere in the British Empire, which, of course, had huge empty spaces to be colonized. And some were suspicious, but most thought, no, the British, they've given their word of honor, they're honorable, decent people. Of course this is true. And no one was more enthusiastic than General Krasnov, who was with them. He was too old to actually to have taken a command, but he accompanied them. And he advised them, he said, no, we'll go to the conference. If we don't go, it'll look bad. So they got into trucks. But, of course, Field Marshal Alexander was in his headquarters in Naples. He didn't know anything about this. They were rushed in trucks and taken right across southern Austria to the Soviet demarcation line at a town called Judenburg, where there's a very narrow ravine, the river Mur, flowing underneath, and a bridge going across. And it was only when they reached this, for the most part, that the Cossack officers found they'd been betrayed. And some managed to commit suicide. Sometime and on the way, they were held in a barracks for a night. They hanged themselves with lavatory chains or cut their throats with razors. Others, one or two others, threw themselves off the bridge as the trucks were crossing into the Soviet zone. They knew what was going to happen to them. And sure enough, they were sent off to the forced labor camps, and the great majority died. We know that because when Khrushchev came to power, he decided to appear more liberal than Stalin, to release any old émigrés, as the whites were called, who were not Soviet citizens, and send them back to the West. But there was only a tiny number, by that 11 years in the camps, who were still alive. The rest had died. But meanwhile, back in the camp, there was about 25,000 Cossacks. The official figure, which Field Marshal Alexander reported to Churchill, was that there were 11,000 old men, women, and children. They could not possibly have been serving in the German army. And indeed, the children, who included babies, of course, couldn't possibly have ever been Soviet citizens, seeing they couldn't have been born in the Soviet Union. Nevertheless, on the 1st of June and the next day, 1945, British troops arrived with armored cars and fixed bayonets and went in, and the most horrible scenes took place of people being beaten over the head, old men, a baby taken from its mother and thrown into a cattle truck. There was a stream of cattle trucks waiting nearby to take them. No mercy was shown. Many of the British soldiers, of course, were deeply ashamed of what they were doing. And during these atrocities, well, I met many of these people. Now they're now, I think, all dead. But I remember one in particular, Zoe Polanska, who managed to escape and live in Scotland. There was one point when the whole crowd was being battered by the British soldiers, and they were forced through a fence and through a barracks, and she was in the barrack room and was forced out of the window, and the broken glass cut through the backs of her thighs to the bone. She was still dragged by British soldiers, thrown into a cattle truck. As she was in there, the British medical officer, I met him too and interviewed him, saw she was bleeding profusely, he ordered her out and bandaged her and treated her. And then he put her on one side. So she was one of the very few who escaped. People did escape, and indeed it wasn't difficult to escape. It was largely because they trusted the British that they more didn't try to escape. And she then eventually ended up in Scotland and even appeared as a witness in the, which I'll come to, the Aldington trial. She was so angry at the contempt the judge showed for the poor victims that she said to me, she now spoke with a mixed Russian and Scottish accent, she said, "Nicola, I nearly threw my knickers at the judge." So she had a good sense of humour too. These are the horrors which happened. It was kept completely secret. No one... I was only a boy, but nevertheless we all avidly followed what was going on in and after the war. No one talked about it. George Orwell was the only person who talked about, not about the Cossacks, but about people being handed over at all, because as a journalist he'd actually witnessed a bit of it. And he wrote very condemningly about it. But that was one article. They wouldn't allow anything else to be published. And the story was kept secret. People that wanted to believe the best of the Soviets and so on. But then came a time when learned that, first of all, I learned that Nicholas Bethel was writing his book. I can't remember at this minute why I started preparing the book, but I had. And then when Nicholas Bethel's book came out, I resolved then I would write a book. But I thought, as Nicholas Bethel is the first, well, then mine better be, well, as I vainly said, the best. Well, I didn't know about that. But I did have big advantages, actually. Sometimes I felt that as if a sort of divine providence was steering me in one direction rather than another. Because a great advantage I had, Nicholas Bethel's book must have been finished in 1973, and that was the year the British started releasing documents about from the war. It was 2 years, there was a 30-year rule, it had to be 30 years after the event that things were released in the Public Record Office. But because it was silly not to include the two last years of the war, they released them in 1973. And it was a nice Ukrainian friend who recommended, who gave me this copy of Contra. But he also said, "I think you should see what's going on in the Public Record Office." So I went and looked, and straight away I saw that there was now someone could write a book. There was astonishing evidence. The most astonishing thing to me was the sheer numbers of people handed over. I'd always assumed that it was a trickle, you know, of, I don't know what, a few hundred people caught up in the utter confusion, and understandably, nobody quite knew what was happening, handed over. It wasn't like that at all. It was the British handed over just over 1 million people, and the Americans slightly more, so it came to about 2.25 million. The other countries in Europe, incidentally, France handed over quite several thousand. Even this neutral Switzerland secretly made sure they went back. The Americans sent back, as I said, over 1 million. Even from America, who are prisoners of war, who'd been taken back to the States, were taken all the way from the States and handed back. And there was only one country in Europe, or indeed the world, which flatly refused to obey Stalin's demands. And that was Liechtenstein, which had no army and a police force of 12. And I went to Liechtenstein and met the prince, and so many people were alive then that I could interview, and the prime minister, and a battalion of 800 Russian soldiers under a white Russian general had retreated into Liechtenstein. They thought of staying in Austria, but someone warned the general, he told me, Smyslovsky his name was, don't stay in Austria. The Allies, you can't trust them. Go to, and don't go on to Switzerland. Stop in Liechtenstein. And he did that. And he was saved. The Soviets sent a delegation from Smirsch into Liechtenstein, and they're the only Smirsch people engaged in this unsavory work, of whom photographs survive, because there was a charming Russian baron, a white emigre living in Switzerland, who was a keen photographer, Baron Falz-Fein, and he took numerous photos of these, and they could have been out of Hollywood Central casting. They're really repulsive, sinister-looking people. But both the prince and the people and the ordinary Liechtenstein people were determined that no one should go back, unless they chose to, of course. So then after, I think, 2 or 3 months, they were given the choice. And I haven't got the exact figures, but I think roughly a third, surprisingly one might think, volunteered to go back. Well, people did then, because for a start, Stalin sent people to make lavish promises of how well they'd be treated when they got home. It wasn't their fault they were prisoners and so on and so forth. But two-thirds wouldn't go back in any circumstances. And one, a woman, they had a few women with families with them, recognized one of the Smirsch delegation as a man who had tortured her in a camp. So this, of course, spread around, and so they didn't go back. The ones who did go were, I think, all slaughtered. There's no record of any of them surviving. So it shows you can. I said to the prince, but weren't you nervous? After all, the Red Army was almost on your doorstep, and Switzerland could have, the Red Army had an army, I think, by that stage of 15.5 million. You haven't got an army. The prince said, no. But I spoke to them firmly, and that's the language they understand. And I said in my book, if only the British and the Americans could have taken that moral. Well, then, I worked hard. I had to go all day. It took me 4 years of research, partly in these British documents, but much more importantly, it seemed to me, or as important, rather, was to find as many eyewitnesses as I could. And I was in a very fortunate position because I was, obviously brought up in England. I went to a famous military school, Wellington College. I was in the British Army, not very long because I was invalided out. And, but at the same time, obviously, I'm Russian by blood and by ancestry. So when I interviewed British officers, which are many of them, some are very senior rank, with fascinating stories, they trusted me because I'd been to the same school as them very often, and I was obviously sympathetic to the predicament which these British officers were put in. They were given strict orders, they had to obey, they didn't know why it was. Often they were lied to and told, well, British prisoners won't be liberated by the Soviets unless we hand these over. And of course any country, people would have to prefer their own countrymen to those, however unsympathetic one felt, who were foreigners. So I did feel instant sympathy, and I think and believe, and I tape recorded all the conversations, they spoke to me very frankly. But also, and probably more difficult, was to get Russian refugees to speak, because many of them remained terrified after what their countrymen had been through, that the British would hand them over again. But as they knew I was Russian and obviously sympathetic to them, they too spoke very freely. So I did get fascinating interviews on the ground. And so when I published Victims of Yalta, I was able to give, I think, a very full picture of what happened. I won't go into it because I want to get on to the things which happened after that. Well, then, time went by, and I wrote other books. I don't only write about Soviet crimes or British crimes. Some are very far distant. I wrote a book about Merlin, and I'm writing one about King Arthur now. But I remained fascinated by the subject, and from time to time, fresh evidence seemed to arise. And the most important thing was that a friend, I think he was a Serb, anyway, some from Yugoslavia, said, you've written a very good book about the Cossacks, the Russians, but what about us poor Yugoslavs? We were handed over from Austria at the same time. So I began to look into this, and I said, my initial interest still remained with the Russians, and for obvious reason, but I was also interested, and then it struck me that as these operations happened exactly the same place and the same time, if I knew more about the Yugoslav handovers, that would also throw a light, possibly, on why the British acted as they did in Austria. So I then set to work. In some ways, the Yugoslav story, well, it couldn't be worse, but if it could be, it almost would be, because the British handed over, I think, about, I haven't got the figures in my about 70,000 maybe Yugoslavs. Well, I say Yugoslavs for convenience. They were actually Croats, Slovenes, North Italy, were not sent back. And they were told they were going to go to be with General Damjanovic and the Serbs, who'd fought on the Allied side, the Chetniks, throughout the war. They were unlike the Cossacks, they hadn't even been associated with the enemy. They were lied to, and they were told, and Tito had virtually every single one of them killed. They were taken to huge natural pits, underground caverns, well, huge chasms as big as a room. One about half the size of this room, the one I went to, because in 1990, when Yugoslavia collapsed, moving ahead slightly, I was taken secretly. The regime hadn't fallen, but it was crumbling. I was taken, it was quite exciting, really, by priests who took me from one, smuggled me from one house to another and into the forest where the pits were. We saw, Tito made no attempt to hide them. The bones and skulls were piled over. They've uncovered many more now, Yugoslav. So I thought, well, why did this happen too? So I said to my friends from Croatians or Serbs, I will investigate this. And then I published a book called The Minister and the Massacres. Well, half the book was about the Yugoslavs, which I'm not really going to say any more about tonight. And the other half was about the responsibility, as it seemed to me on the evidence, of Harold Macmillan. And that played a very big part in what was to follow. Harold Macmillan was the political advisor, minister resident, as they called him, to Field Marshal Alexander. The headquarters of Alexander's command was far away from Austria. It was a huge royal palace outside Naples. And Macmillan, sorry, was the minister resident. He gave political advice to Alexander, which Alexander accepted. He was a fighting soldier and didn't in fact politics much. And Macmillan, on the 12th of May, flew up. He was sent by Alexander to go to see what was happening. Now, we were almost going to go to war with Tito, who was trying to conquer a large chunk of North Italy and a large chunk of southern Austria, and the British were anxious to stop this happening. So Macmillan flew on the 12th. When he arrived at the army headquarters, that's in North Italy, he got a message from the British commander in Austria, General Keighley, saying he had something very, very important and delicate to discuss with him. And he must have given a clue as to what it was about, because Macmillan changed his prearranged tour and flew to Austria. And there he met the British General Keighley and General Keighley's chief of staff, a man called Brigadier Toby Lowe, afterwards Lord Aldington. And what at the conference itself, we know best from what Macmillan wrote in his own diary, which he published later, but before I'd written about him, so he didn't realize the implications of letting this be known. He said, I spoke with General Keighley, he's a very good man, and we have agreed to hand over to the Soviets all the Cossacks and the White Russians. So it was there in black and white that he not only, bad enough, was handing over the Cossacks, but knowingly said, include the White Russian emigres. And later on, he, in an interview on television with Ludovic Kennedy, he said, well, I imagine they were people who, he didn't think they were, as has been pretended on his behalf, that he didn't quite know who the White Russians were. He said, I think they were people like Prince Obolensky, whom we knew living in Paris. In other words, they were White Russian emigres like my father. So I won't go into all the evidence, I can't hear, it is in the book, and more evidence has come to light since. And I accused Macmillan of having made the recommendation, or more than a recommendation, what was described at the time as a verbal directive to hand over the white, include the white Russians. Well, this is not only wicked for the number of people involved, but if you think, if maybe, I'm only guessing, but if 2,000 emigre officers were handed over, if you compare that with the 2.25 million, you might say, well, it's tragic, but you know, it's disproportionate just to focus on them. But the reason I focused on them was because I thought if something is wrong as that, which was actually contrary to Allied policy, then what on earth was going on? There's something much more murky than merely obeying orders. People who defend what happened then and since will give answers which might occur to anyone as being common sense. Why did we agree to these forced handovers? Handovers of willing people, of course, no one could object to. Well, the first one is that we got back British prisoners of war in exchange. And that, if true, of course, as I said, is a very powerful argument, and one which would be very difficult, at the very least, to say that it was entirely wrong. It was actually untrue. And now, in my present book, I'm able to show exactly what happened at the negotiations with the Soviets. And it is completely clear, in the words of both parties, that the return of British prisoners of war was discussed completely separately. No opposition, there was no obstacle to returning the British prisoners of war, though many were still being sent back by Odessa. So that one can, I mean, when I say these things, I say them as if they were fact, but the evidence is in my book. The second argument is that, I've forgotten, there's such bad arguments, but I can't remember. I will remember in a minute. Anyway, I'm sorry, I had the most important argument, which was that we were as I mentioned, on the eve of what appeared to be war with Tito. In the end, Tito was frightened and gave in, but which wasn't to be known. And it said that the argument was that the British Fifth Corps in Austria had, there were not only Cossacks, there were about, I think, 500,000 German prisoners of war, that they couldn't possibly look after all these people and fight Tito. That would be beyond what anyone could believe, and that it was, we had no means of, Lord Alderton himself said, we had no means of feeding them, no means of looking after them. What else could we do except hand them back to the Soviets? Well, actually, as I show in my book for the first time, that was a complete lie on his part. Field Marshal Alexander received reports that there were Cossacks with their camp followers and the 11,000 women and children, he at once Field Marshal Alexander, I may say there are heroes and villains in my story, but one of the heroes is Field Marshal Alexander. He was, by every standard, and not just as involved with the Cossacks, but throughout his career, a man of astonishingly, he was a great devout Christian, very strong morals and principles. He said, war is a beastly business, but if we have to fight, we're going to fight decently and according to proper principles. And he, the moment he heard about the Cossacks, he sent a telegram straight away to Churchill and said, we've got these people in Austria, and we can't. We don't know what to do with them, but to hand them back to their countries of origin, Soviet Union and Yugoslavia, could be fatal to their health. Well, everyone would know what that meant. Churchill certainly knew. Churchill immediately sent a message on the next day. He felt so urgently about it, to Eisenhower in Germany, who commanded all the Allied troops in Germany, and he said, I totally agree with them. Alexander said, can Eisenhower take them in his zone? Because we haven't got, they're too much of a responsibility if we're going to war. And so Churchill immediately sent a message. All these things happened in 3 days, so much was the urgency. He sent a message to Eisenhower and said, look, please, can you take these Cossacks in your zone? That's too much for Alexander. Eisenhower had a lot of problems of his own, but he initially said, I'm not sure that I can. But then when Churchill pleaded, he immediately agreed and sent a message saying, yes, we will take them in Austria. Now, you might think that this is all, and as I think I did a bit, these are telegrams passing through the air and not known to the soldiers on the ground. But that wasn't the case, because as I discovered, Eisenhower acted immediately. His attitude was just as humane and honorable as Alexander's or Churchill's. And he immediately gave orders that three divisions of what they call cavalry, because that means armor, should be sent at once to Austria, first of all, to deal with Tito, if necessary, and secondly, to evacuate the Cossacks and bring them into Germany, where they could be looked after safely. And he put General Patton in charge. Well, Patton, as many of you will recall, was not a man to waste time on these things. He immediately sent not only the three divisions with instructions his message to his commanding generals said, if Tito plays ball, fine. If not, kick him out. And he then, at the same time, they sent 800 lorries across the mountains. It was 4 foot of snow in the passes, but Patton wouldn't let anyone waste time. And they arrived on the edge of the British zone and immediately made contact with the nearest British unit, which was, in fact, the 78th Division, which was holding the Cossacks, and said, we've come to relieve you of responsibility for them. But that very same day, a message was sent by Brigadier Lowe, Lord Aldington as he became, to higher command, which said, we don't want the Americans here. The Cossacks are very easy to look after, no problem to us whatever. Now, none of this, when it came to the famous or infamous 1989 libel action, which for those many people have no reason to remember that now. But shortly after my book, The Minister and the Massacres, was published, it caused a big stir. I think most reviewers said that I'd made a very strong case and it should be properly looked into. Some were angry and said that I just made it all up. But there was some sympathy for that. Someone I knew, he didn't really have any interest in the Cossacks, but he'd had some private quarrel with Lord Aldington. And Lord Aldington was warden of Winchester College. And this chap said to me, well, I agree with him. It's a disgrace that such a man who's responsible for such a monstrous crime should be in charge or theoretically at the head of a college bringing up young people. And so he sent out a leaflet. I wrote the leaflet because he didn't really know what it was about. And the heading of it was War Crimes and the Wardenship of Winchester College. It was only two sides of an A4 paper, I think. I accused Aldington of the crimes of which he personally had been the part he played as being responsible. Lord Aldington then, as was expected, issued a writ for libel against the man who had this private quarrel with him. I said to my lawyers who were advising me at that time, but I think he should sue me because I wrote it, and poor Nigel, this other chap, he doesn't know anything about it. He'd never stand a chance in court. So my lawyers wrote to Lord Aldington and said, we think you ought to know that Count Tolstoy, our client, wrote the pamphlet, so no doubt you'll wish to sue him. Oh, no, said Aldington. No, I've no quarrel with Count Tolstoy, whatever. So then they wrote a second letter. He still refused. And then what I didn't know, and I learned a lot about the law over the last 30 or so years, that I could insist on his suing me. I still don't quite know why. So I said, well, right, go ahead, because at least I know what I'm talking about. So Aldington then grudgingly said, oh, yes, well, I was going to sue him after all, so I will. And then we had the trial, That's when I began to discover things about Britain which I never dreamt of and never thought I would, and which I hadn't. It was the hearing was in the autumn of 1989, and it took a year, I think, or more to prepare the evidence. Well, there was a huge amount of evidence, but we weren't allowed to call witnesses to describe how they'd been maltreated by the British. That was banned. No reason was given, but it was banned. I was rather excited, to be honest, because I thought now we can bring it out in the open. Aldington will be cross-examined and will have to answer. The evidence which I've amassed, all these documents, piles of them, will be brought in evidence. And for once, we'll actually see Aldington before that had been as wriggly as an eel. He wouldn't be interviewed by anyone or see anyone, but he will have to answer in court. So I admit it, I was pleased and excited. But Georgina was not so excited when we arrived, first of all, because it was court number 13. But secondly, for more sensible reason, was that what followed. Well, actually, it wasn't long before I realized she was right. She said, this isn't a proper trial. It's been fixed. Well, the first thing we knew was that there was hardly anybody from the public was allowed in. There's a gallery, but the gallery was closed and there was no one in it. And one or two friends of mine, there was very little room for the public because there were numbers of lawyers and journalists who occupied. It was a very small courthouse anyway. It was, I think I'm right, much considerably smaller than this theatre. And a friend who'd managed to get in amongst and sit next to us, a former naval officer who was outraged by the whole story, had a message passed up to the judge, and the judge read it out, and it said, why is the public gallery closed? If ever there was a case that the public should be admitted to, this is surely it. And the judge read this out, then he said, well, the trouble is that there's a building defects and the public gallery is dangerous to sit in, so we've had to close it. So then the next day, this pertinacious officer sent another message saying, it's been drawn to my attention that 3 weeks ago, at a former hearing that your lordship presided over, the public gallery was full. So what's happened in the interval? The judge then said, there's so much public feeling about this, they were frightened that an assassin might get in and kill someone. There's no remote likelihood of such a thing, of course. Anyway, it contradicted what he just said. So the next thing came was at the same time, rather, was the swearing in of the jury. Now, this was a case which of necessity involved hundreds, if not thousands, of documents, understanding of orders passed up and down, and so on. But one of the jurors proved to be illiterate. But the judge said, that's all right, I think. And a few days later, it turned out that the judge himself said that he had been inquiring into the jurors and their backgrounds. He said he'd made the inquiry, which showed that they were extremely intelligent people and fit to hear a trial. Oh, thanks. Is that better? Yes. Sorry. So he then said, well, we then carried on with the illiterate juror and the others. Moving ahead in the trial, 2 months later, after complicated hearings, discussions and so on, the judge ruled, and there's a record kept, very fortunately for me, in the air, as it proved, of every word spoken during the trial, and which you, at the end of each day, so lawyers can examine it, are given a printed version, and that's done very efficiently. But when it came to the jurors' hearing, they were not allowed to look at this transcript. They had to guess what they'd seen 2 months earlier, 1 month earlier. So it certainly didn't look promising. And at the end, the judge summed up, well, I can't go into, not supposed to go into detail, but it was such a biased, and his treatment of the witnesses was so atrocious that by the end, pretty well everyone, except, of course, Aldington and his friends, agreed that the judge, who incidentally had he wasn't chosen at random out of the judiciary to hear this case. He himself applied to hear it. And 6 months after the trial was over,
a newspaper reporter found out that Lord Aldington and the judge lived 6 miles apart in Kent and belonged to the same private golf club, which was between their houses. But appeal court judges, when I appealed, said, well, that's quite all right, we don't worry about that. In actual fact, in legal practice in Britain, the judge should have declared this interest and said, if anyone feels this disqualifies me, I'll stand down and another judge. But he concealed it. And then I began to find out just what can go on in English courts. And really, it surprised me, and still does, because not only in the court concluded by the judge, after his summing up, he said, now do you find the prisoner, well, I don't think I was a prisoner, defendant, sorry, guilty or not guilty? And the foreman said, guilty. So then he said, how much damages do you award? Well, I thought he'd said, for a second, I thought he said £1,500. It was £1.5 million, and £500,000 to pay for Lord Aldington's lawyers. And the judge had instructed them. He said, whatever you do, don't give Mickey Mouse damages. I think that was in his ignorance. He maybe thought Mickey Mouse was a giant. But anyway, the jury took this advice and gave the damages. Actually, it was one of the worst things that could have happened to Lord Aldington, because, well, first of all, I couldn't pay it, obviously. Secondly, it alerted people all around the world, because it was a record. It was 3 times bigger than any other award in British legal history. And it was eventually condemned by the European Court of Human Rights, who said it violated my right to democracy. But we then had the story didn't stop there. They obviously, people didn't like me, the judges and Lord Aldington and his friends, thought the whole thing was over. Because not only did the judge, there was a fund had been set up by supporters, who included very distinguished people, to pay for our lawyers, because we couldn't afford to pay them. And they were people very generous. And the fund was set up, so it wasn't actually my money at all. And it wasn't even Georgina, it was set up under trustees. But the judge, sometimes the law didn't seem to exist. He froze the fund, said that we couldn't pay lawyers, so we couldn't go to have any lawyers to represent me at appeal. So I went to the appeal court and had to plead for myself, but they just said, dismissed me completely and said I had to pay the whole sum or else. But we then, luckily history is big enough, I don't know about in contemporary woke British universities, but it should be, where all the evidence, not only is a vast amount of evidence available, especially in contemporary history, but there are even people alive who remember things. So it was very unlikely and a very ludicrous thing in a way, as well as sinister, to judge a historical event in a court of law, which restricts the amount of evidence, some of it for good reason, but mostly not, as in my case anyway. And so the more evidence inevitably it turns up. No serious historian expects that his book, however well researched, any more than mine, that something will turn up, which I don't know about at this minute. But some astonishing things began to turn up. Well, first of all, Lord Aldington had won the case on his alibi, because he left on, we now know he left on 23rd of May. He claimed he left at dawn on the 22nd. Now, this may appear a piffling issue, but it isn't at all, because on the morning of the 22nd of May, the fatal order was given to hand over the Cossacks and to shoot to kill anyone resisting arrest. Flagrant violation of the Geneva Convention or of British treatment of prisoners of war generally. And Aldington said, well, I wasn't there because I'd left. He gave a very suspicious alibi. He said, I flew over the mountains. Of course, I remember it because I could see the snow beneath me. Then we arrived. I was got to Naples to change planes. I was stuck there for 2 days. So I didn't actually, because we could show the date he got back to England, which was the 24th. two missing days he spent in Naples. He could not produce a single witness or describe anything that he did during those 2 days, even though he was the chief of staff coming from what was the actual hotbed of what Alexander was wanting to know about, the conflict with Tito. So it was very suspicious. Anyway, there was no snow on the mountains. It had rained, and there were no flights the day he supposed to have left because it had rained all day, and we found the RAF records for the aerodrome at Klagenfurt. So in any case, it was a pretty feeble alibi. But in May of the following year, we found the signal from his own corps headquarters giving the date that he left, and it was the 23rd, so he had been there at the conference and had lied throughout the whole of the trial. We then had to had my lawyers advised to sue Lord Aldington for perjury. This greatly unnerved the judiciary and the establishment generally, and the hearing was heard in a small room in the basement, and it was secret. The public and press were not allowed in. Georgina was allowed in, but nobody else. And it was heard before a judge. Well, he'd previously been found perjuring himself in a court before he was made a judge. Andrew Scott, his name was. And the hearing was held there, and this document was produced. And I'd also, because I knew the judges would, I'd got seen enough to know what was in danger of, with the judge that... I tracked down the British colonel who was in charge of this signals unit and tape recorded an interview, and he explained why this entry could not be wrong. Well, the main reason was because, as the logbook shows, it was so important that messages should get through to high command accurately that if anything was wrong, it was immediately corrected within an hour or two. So, and he said that cannot be wrong, and made a tape-recorded interview on that. Well, the judge the judge said, well, that record must be wrong. So my QC, who was very, very experienced, said, I remember he went bright red with anger, and he said, well, why not, my lord? And he said, well, because Lord Aldington says it isn't true. And then my counsel, Alan Jones, he said, well, I'm not going to go on with this case because it's obviously a farce and the judge has made up his mind and there's no point in proceeding. But then we had the case in the European Court, which was going on at this moment, and my lawyers explained that you have to have exhausted every domestic remedy in the British courts before you can take a case to Strasbourg. So he said, we need to go through with it, even if it's only if it is a farce. So Alan Jones reluctantly agreed, but he said, I'm only agreeing if there's a record of everything that's passed in this 3-day hearing. And he was assured by that. I was there. The clerk of the court said no, and he pointed, and in the ceiling there was a sort of recess, and he said, there's a tape recorder there. There are two tape recorders in case one breaks down. They record every day's proceedings, and then the stenographer that evening works so that there's a record the next day. Well, when the 3 days were over, the judge said that I was guilty completely, that the perjury case was to be thrown out, and Aldington was a decent, honourable man. So then my solicitor said, well, can we have the transcript, please, because we're going to take this to appeal. Oh, dear, I was there when it happened. The clerk of the court said, well, it's most unfortunate, but on every one of the days, both tape recorders broke down, so there isn't a record. So then we went to appeal, but he wanted to stop me going to appeal because he said any lawyer who represents Count Tolstoy from now on will be fined and made to pay the whole costs of the hearing. So, of course, no firm of lawyers could represent me after that. And so when I went to the hearing and spoke, but the judges judged on what Aldington's barristers said had happened. And so the judges said, well, that must be true. So again, I was wrong. Aldington, I see in my book, I quote a couple of very good newspaper articles written at the time, said he'd had 16 judges, I think correctly, finding in his favour, he said, which must say something. Well, I think it does say something. So that was that as far as the law was concerned. And it finally reached a point where we could go no further in law. But again, it was almost as if divine providence intervened. Suddenly, the trial was in 1989. These legal proceedings, I think, probably were 91 or 2, possibly. The Soviet Union began to crumble and collapse, as did the communist regime in Yugoslavia. And then a very powerful spokesman on my behalf was Solzhenitsyn, who'd paid for Victims of Yalta to be translated into Russian and published by the Russian publishing house IMCA in Paris. And then Solzhenitsyn returned to Russia, and he became very friendly with Yeltsin. Now, I know Yeltsin had a very dire Russian fault, which Yarik says admits that Poles have too, which is a proclivity for strong drink. But he started off very well. Well, he did one thing which, for me, makes him a hero forever. On the day he became president, not many people know this, I think, he closed down every single communist institution, all communist political parties, all party headquarters, all newspapers, all publishers were stopped. I think that law still stands, but I don't know. But anyway, Solzhenitsyn, who saw Yeltsin quite a lot, said to him, well, can't we help to poor Tolstoy, what's happening to him in England? And Yeltsin was very supportive. And I found in my diary for that, I think it'll be about 1992, it says, 3 times this week, Yeltsin's head of chancery telephoned me to ask, they said, the president wants to help you, but he doesn't know what he can do to help. On the third occasion, he said, would it help if I opened up the Russian secret archives to him? I said, I think it might. And the next thing I knew, I flew to Moscow. And first of all, I met General Volkogonov, who was a distinguished historian, wrote very good biographies of Lenin, Stalin, and Trotsky. They've been translated into English. And he was explaining to me how a ministerial car had been sent to take me around all the ministries. And he said, he was explaining to me where I would be going and so on. And then he said, he paused at one point and he said, how come people in England don't understand what everyone in Russia knows is true? And then a little bit later, he said, right, well, I've arranged now and you can go to all the following ministries and they will show you, they have strict orders to show you everything relevant. And he said, he smiled and he said, well, you see, your name still carries some weight in our country. Well, it was lucky for me. Anyway, I was taken to the ministries. I was given allowed to look through everything and take photocopies away with me of everything I saw. And I found myself going where sometimes when I'd had in the past one or two bad dreams, I dreamt of being like the Cossack generals in the Lubyanka. Well, I did go to the Lubyanka. And the first thing I saw, I was staying when I was in Moscow with a friend who was a very distinguished Russian actor whose most popular role was being Sherlock Holmes on Russian television. And when I passed through a big relaxation area where all these KGB officers were sitting, and they were all watching television and they were all watching Sherlock Holmes. So when I got home, I wrote to the Times and I said, I can now reveal where they get their information from. Anyway, there in Lubyanka, I met the deputy head of the KGB, General Kandaurov. He was very polite to me, but he had a slight look. I didn't think I'd like to see him open the door of my cell if I were in one. But he was very courteous, and he said and he showed me the room where the Cossack generals were interrogated, which is described in One Who Escaped. I returned home with a massive parcel of wonderful documents, which I've now had copied and distributed. So if there's anybody who shouldn't be here wondering, they're not easy to destroy. And I found that the documents there contained absolute dynamite, particularly on the question of the handover of the white Russian emigres. There is the agreement, and that they should be included. It was formally agreed after Macmillan's arrival. And subsequently, which again comes in this book, I obtained a complete transcript of the account of the Smirsch officer who came into the British zone and negotiated the handover of the white emigre officers. And that is, combined with the Soviet documents, is absolute dynamite. At the same time, there's other very important documentation from the American archives, which I hadn't previously seen, and from the British. Well, I'll give one example of what happened with the British documents. I told you how we discovered after the trial, and in this book it's described in detail, how the Americans sent the 800 trucks to rescue the Cossacks. We didn't know about that at the trial, and why not? Well, the documents come in a very bulky file. I can even remember it's the War Office document 170/1042. It completely, there's an operation, the operation to kick out Tito and to rescue the Cossacks was called Operation Coldstream, and that's the title of this dossier. We didn't have that dossier during the trial, and it would, of course, have been dynamite because it would show the Aldington's claim that the Cossacks were impossible to look after was just thrown out of the window. And he'd obviously, it would not only show that he was wrong, but also that he lied. Why couldn't we show this document? The year immediately after Aldington issued his writ, all this we discovered subsequently, the War Office, the Ministry of Defence as it now is, ordered that file to be removed from the Public Record Office and brought back to the Ministry of Defence. And how do I know? And there it was kept. During the trial, we realised, I forget how we knew that this was an important file. And we wanted it. We couldn't get it from the Public Record Office. Then application was made to the Ministry saying, can we please have this very important document? They sent a doctored version of it. I forget how many pages it has, maybe 150. And we got about 25 pages, which were about nothing at all, really. Then, after the trial was over, a whistleblower in the Ministry of Defence was so disgusted, that again is described in here, so disgusted by what was going on. He was head of the department for hiding all the documents that could have helped us in the defence. And they're listed, so it's not just guesswork what might have been in them. And one of them was this very important one, the 1020/42. And this was only discovered after the trial. I then got onto, I forget how, Thames Television, told them what we'd found out. It must have been the Foreign Office who held it, because it was Douglas Hurd, who was Foreign Secretary, said it's very unfortunate, but we can't find the document. It seems to have gone missing. And then Thames Television, then we told them, this was a very exciting story, they were going to make a full hour-long documentary about it. Then suddenly they were obliged, of course, to, at the end when they'd done their research, found that my story was true, applied to Douglas Hurd and said, what's happened to this document? We're making this moment, they heard a television program was being made. Douglas Hurd wrote back and said, it's most unfortunate, it was lost, but it's now been discovered by a charwoman in a broom cupboard. And so we can let you see it. He had the choice of, and had no choice, rather had no choice, handed it over. So we got the file, and of course I have it now at home. And we saw why the Foreign Office had hidden it. All these things could happen, and judges, the government, and still, not only is it has nothing happened, I'm forbidden even with this speech I'm making to you, I could be sent to prison for making, because I've said that Lord Aldington was a war criminal. And of course he was. And one would think that this was a sort of third world country or somewhere behind the Iron Curtain, but unfortunately it goes on in Britain. I'm not saying it goes on all the time, it doesn't. But when it comes to a big thing like this, it is very scary to see what the authorities can do. But it still applies. This book, I'm glad in a way, it couldn't be published in Britain. Publishers were scared stiff. So it's published by an American publisher, but the books are actually, can be and are printed in England. But again, it was one of those fortuitous things which seemed at the time unfair to me that the British publishers were scared. But actually, it's much better having an American publisher because they couldn't care less about, well, anyway, English libel laws are so appallingly weighted in favour of the rich and powerful that they're actually ruled unconstitutional in the United States, so you can't apply for them to be enforced in America. So there's much which I know a British publisher would have nervously said, I didn't think you could say that, you mustn't say that. No, I didn't. Everything's in the book. So it's really, at last, I'm sure other things will be discovered, but they can't overturn it because now the direct evidence is so strong, both for the crime which was made occurred in 1945, and the behaviour of the judges and some. I can't mention everything because it's impossible. This conspiracy was so wide ranging. The government set up a secret committee which purported to be independent. And a man called Brigadier Cowgill came to see me, and he said, I'm doing research, and I want to set up an independent committee which will support what you've written, and it'll be all the more valuable because we're seen to be independent. Well, to cut the story short, they immediately before the trial, they published a report which allegedly showed that everything I'd said was untrue, and this was done on the very eve of the trial, and I couldn't answer it. And on the day that the publication was about to happen, it happened that I was going to give some lectures in Chile. And that morning, I told Brigadier Cowgill I was going, and that morning he rang and he said, so are you definitely off to Chile this morning? I said, yes, I can't really talk, so I've got to go now. It was the next day they published the report. And then the Times reported that, and so did other newspapers, that I couldn't be found to respond. Very convenient. The Sunday Times was the only paper which actually took the trouble to ask Georgina where I was and then to telephone me in Chile. Anyway, this committee then, that was supposed to influence the jury, which I guess it did, judging by the outcome. But it didn't influence the British public. And also, there were quite a lot of vociferous and well-placed voices in journalism who said that this report is rather sinister, to say the least. So then out came another report, but this time in two fat volumes, denouncing me even more strongly and saying that I was a liar and all the rest of it. And this time, the press was... Well, there wasn't much comment, but the press was pretty obsequious and endorsed it and said it's a marvellous work of historical research. And and then finally, one of the members was a rather ludicrous figure, and he's dead now, so I shouldn't say harsh things, called Christopher Booker, who didn't believe in global warming and thought that the aliens were about to invade the Earth. But he then wrote a book also. One of the interesting things which I've been able to show in my book is to the shameless extent to which these government reports, we discovered that Cowgill, so far from being a bluff brigadier ex-army type, it was one of a rather romantic scene. We had the War and Peace Ball in those days at the Café Royal where we dressed up like our ancestors in the 19th century. And there was a cousin of mine, Prince Obolensky, and his beautiful wife. He was in imperial uniform and she in a nice court dress. But she was a very clever girl, Anne Marie, and she worked for an international detective agency, Kroll Associates. And she said, I was talking about Brigadier Cowgill. So she said, well, wait a minute, I'll find out about him. Well, she went to her boss and they did a search on Cowgill. But he was a long-serving MI6 officer, as it turned out. So there didn't seem to be any way I could look. And probably they might have hoped that by now I should have kicked the bucket and the official version would be firmly there. And I, in fact, as I've sometimes had to point out, that these terrible crimes took place, but the only person who's guilty, apparently, is me. So you have to keep cheerful. It must be awfully annoying to them that I've still lived to the age I am and have no intention of departing yet. Of course, I've had to skim over the surface, but in my book, it is so satisfying because really, I say it myself. Sometimes when I read a book I've written, I think, oh dear, why did I say that? Why didn't I say that? But this one, the evidence is so clear that even if you took, say, 1/6 of the book, you can see that what happened was utterly wrong, utterly secret, kept a deadly secret, and that the whole of all the judicial suppression, not just of me, but above, well, much more importantly, the truth of what happened has been suppressed. But this book, I hope, British bookshops, no British newspaper has reviewed it, though they've all been sent copies, no magazine has. British bookshops are frightened to read it. So, but as I pointed out in the beginning, that when my previous book, The Minister and the Massacres, was banned by the British government and taken out of every public library and university library, and not everyone, some stood firm, but most in the country, the truth is on record. Truth, I say in inverted commas, as a historian, I know, of course, as I keep saying, that more will be uncovered. But it is so overwhelming, and the evidence now, none of it do I have to say it looks as though this happened or that happened. I now know what happened and can show from beginning to end. Anyway, I've said more than enough, and I believe we're going to have questions, are we?
We indeed are indeed. Thank you very much. Will those members of the audience who wish to ask a question please go to the microphone there? Whilst people are contemplating asking a question, perhaps I shall throw the first one at you. In Russia, of course, there's now President Putin. And were he listening to our live stream, how in Russia is this event now viewed, please?
Well, until recently, I think I would say that the Russians, both government and people, look on me with favour. But then, for instance, I remember being at an opening of the Russian Museum of the Emigration, and a very charming man in ordinary clothes came up to me, and he said, well, you don't know me, but he was a general in the Russian army. And he said, I thought you might like to know that I've made your book compulsory reading for all officers attending the Russian Staff College. And I thought, well, my book's banned in Britain, but it's Russia, it's free. So what a revolution I've seen in my lifetime. But now I think I've a nasty feeling, but only a feeling, that the situation may have changed. For instance, I sent a copy to the Russian ambassador, or to embassy, and I've spoken there before, and I go there from time to time to occasions. I had no reply at all, and I'm rather fearing that what's going on in Russia, there may have been a change.
Thank you very much. I believe we have a question now, please.
Jan Nedvhonsky, Count Nikolai, thank you very much, and congratulations on your fight that you've been fighting for all your life, as far as I can see. Two questions, if I may. One relates to the release of files. We Poles are very sensitive because files related to the death of General Sikorsky are still classified. Could you just very quickly say afterwards, do you think there are any files still kept secret on this, or do you think you've finally got them all? Is there anything else, do you think, still hiding somewhere that you haven't found yet? That's my first question. And my second question is that also, as Poles, we know from our parents, that Poles, having been heroes who fought in the Battle of Britain, became by 1945 or 1946 unwanted immigrants in the UK, a phenomenon that we're now able to experience a bit more in a different context. Do you think fear of unwanted refugees and immigrants was one of the motives behind the British decision or not? Or was it simply being nice to Stalin? Thank you very much.
I'll answer the second question
first, because I need to be reminded of the first one. The second question, no, I don't believe that it was a fear of being swamped by refugees, as in the contemporary world we are, and with some reason. But at the time, don't forget that Britain had her vast empire covering about a sixth of the globe's surface, I think, and which was crying out in different places. A lot of Russians did escape in one way or another, and they went to Argentina, went to Canada, Australia, and I've been there and spoke, met their communities. So it wasn't a problem. But more importantly, no document among the thousands that I've looked at ever raises this as a problem. So I think one can dismiss it. But I've forgotten what, sorry, your
the first question was, do you think there are any files left still?
Oh, sorry. Somewhere? I would guess so, but that's all I can say. But there is an interesting comparison with the Katyn massacre, because I remember when the monument was erected in Gardnersbury Cemetery, and I went there. I was glad to see British officers had been told they weren't allowed to wear uniforms, but I was glad to see there were, and obviously some pretty senior ones did wear uniform. Nothing happened to them. But originally, as I understand it, the monument was going to be erected in a much more central place where people could be properly reminded of the terrible crime in 1940 when the Soviets murdered 15,000, wasn't it, Polish officers. And then pretended the Nazis did it. Everyone knew the truth, but the Foreign Office still went on till the end of the Soviet regime, announcing that it was a Nazi crime, and not announcing, but saying that it was British policy to recognize that it was a Nazi crime. And in the end, the only reason they had to turn around was that the Russians published all the documents, starting with Stalin giving the order at the top and coming right down to the murderers in the field. And I've got that book. It's absolutely invaluable. It should be translated into English, but I don't think it has been, because it's got everything there. But the interesting thing about the move of the monument, or not allowing it to be built in central London, after my book, Victims of Yalta, there was so much outrage that a committee was set up to set up a memorial to the victims of Yalta in London, and they wanted it to be somewhere in central London. And the Foreign Office, as with the Poles and the Katyn Memorial, absolutely said, no, we cannot have it in the middle of London. I can't remember what reason they gave. It's got to be maybe in Gunnersbury, but certainly tucked well away. And a friend of mine who was the secretary of the appeal, we were talking about this, and a couple of days later he rang me and he said, I think you might be interested in a letter I've just received. It was a letter from Mrs. Thatcher sending a cheque for £200 for the memorial. So my friend rang up the Foreign Office and said, I think you might be interested to know who's just written to me. They said, oh, no, of course we don't mind. You can have the memorial in the middle of London. We always really wanted it to be there. It was a mistake. And so there it is, opposite the Natural History Museum.
Thank you.
I have a question now from the live streaming. And it is, Count Nikolai, what gave you the strength to go through the court case and believe in yourself? It sounds like a quite traumatic experience.
Well, it was, and it was awful. But one thing I have to say, and I'm glad I can say it publicly, is that I could not have done what I did without the support of Georgina, who's here, my wife, and who never once, though she's British as the flag, never once said, Nikolai, do you think you're doing the right thing? What about your family? Or anything like that. She was as much for going into it. And indeed, it started right at the beginning when I planned to write the book. I was already suspicious of the officialdom, and we wanted to get copies of all the documents which had been released, but it meant quite a lot of money, because in those days they had to be Xeroxed one by one, perhaps still do, I don't know. And so we were very poor, and we'd saved up money in a building society to buy our first house somehow. And I said, oh dear, well I think, can we use that money? We didn't have any other. And she didn't say, no, what about our home? She said straight away, yes, and she was with me all the way. And so to have a good and brave wife is about the best blessing you can have.
A question now from the audience.
Count Nikolai, the last time we met, you were teaching me. It was about 48 years ago, and I think another of those coincidences, you came and said you had all this information, and I said, you need to speak to my father, who was a fellow teacher at the same school as you, and he was an intelligence officer for the 46th Div, and you did a lot for him to, I mean, he felt terrible about what went on, and it was very cathartic, the information. Incidentally, he's quoted on page 244 of your book. A young intelligence officer, I was only obeying orders. Do you think if the outcome of the war had been different, that people like him would have been held as war criminals?
Well, on the strict legal grounds, and supposing it was a fair tribunal like the Nuremberg Tribunal only judging our people, I think he probably might not have been condemned, because if you were merely transmitting an order without changing it, I have a whole appendix by the top legal expert on the application of the Geneva Convention, and I suspect he might have got off, but who can tell? I have great sympathy for your father and other British soldiers involved, because it was a horrible position. Of course, they didn't know what we know. They didn't know, for instance, that the White Russians were not supposed, in any circumstances, to be sent back. Every single order received in Austria at Aldington and Keatley's command stressed, only people who can be handed over are those who do not need force to repatriate them and who are of undoubted Soviet citizenship. And those orders were disobeyed. So it was not, the British Army is not responsible for this crime, nor are British people. It was kept a deadly secret. And even now, obviously, the British people can't be trusted because they're not allowed to know. And maybe even reading, I don't know if the injunction which makes me imprisonable for publishing this book in Britain applies to people who read it. But given what's happened, it's probably quite likely. But your father's information, as anyone reading it, was extremely helpful, because he was at the meetings, and a meeting too, which where the minutes have been suppressed. And his account, therefore, is of great value, because in particular, because it shows what happened at the meeting.
And at the moment, I can't find his file.
I know you were looking.
We'll find it in the end.
So. Yes.
Thank you very much.
Would you please go up to the microphone there, because of the live stream that we're doing? Please do, yes.
I was thinking while you were speaking that, in a sense, you were a whistleblower of your time. And it must have been very embarrassing for people that were involved in it, either directly or indirectly. So you must be following very closely now the scrutiny of the Foreign Office is under for their handling of Afghanistan and the tremendous cover-up that's going on there.
It is awful, and I think if the book can make government more open and accountable, or helps in some small way, I'd be very glad, because it is worrying that these, after all, they couldn't have done what they did to me in total isolation. It means they have powers and feel entitled to powers which are completely against everything that our country and its history has stood for.
Perhaps we need another Nikolai Tolstoy now to dig deep and find out what really went on with Afghanistan.
Yes. Well, talking of that, of a strange case, when the first volume of Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago came out, he described the poor Russians being handed back, and he said, what Tolstoy will describe this tragedy. And afterwards, as I quote in the book, he said, I didn't know about Nikolai's existence, but he was there.
So hearing you discuss everything, obviously one could get a film about you being rather like that Ealing comedy, is it The Mouse That Roared, that you took on the establishment, and now you've been vindicated.
Yeah.
Maybe Hollywood will come calling.
Yes, because after all, purely from writing as a historian, as I point out in the book, the evidence, particularly the Russian evidence, which I wrote in one of my books, that probably will never see it. But it might have proved me, in major respects, wrong. It's a surprise which not many historians get when there's a treasure trove like that. But on the contrary, it proved me absolutely right.
Please.
Nikolai, Anna Holson Pressinger. When we used to organise the War and Peace Ball together and dance away, I remember being at a dinner party where we were talking about the court cases and things, and I was madly sticking up for you, of course, and old friends, and I very much was sat on at the dinner party, metaphorically speaking, because it was very much the old school tie, that they were all sticking up for Lord Orlington, their great friend. And so I think that you probably, sadly, were the victim of that more than anything, that everybody closes rank. But taking up the last questioner's view about a film, what about going to Julian Fellowes, who we were at university with, and an old friend generally of all of us, but wouldn't he be rather a good person to approach about doing a film? Because I think that idea is brilliant. And then everything be said, particularly as your publisher is American, so Hollywood was definitely...
Yes, yeah, well, it would be marvellous, yes, and it would make a very exciting film.
I will give it to Julian for Christmas.
Thank you. Yes, that's...
Please.
I'd like to say I really applaud your courage, and I really want to stand up.
Thank you.
My father led a cavalry charge. He was in the Polish army in 1939 against the Germans. There's a statue of him in Poland. He's smiling. He could get a bullet at any moment, but he's smiling. And I think you have that kind of courage. Of course, these things hurt, and I'm sure that you've gone through periods of great anxiety at times and so on. But the key thing that you said tonight that really impressed me is that when the Soviets arrived at Victoria Station and these people, these what looked like thugs, bundled you away, and you hit one of them and knocked them out, and you said of yourself, "I'm actually quite pugnacious," or words to that effect. I really like that. And I think sometimes we have to be. On a different note, so I salute you, and I take my hat off to you, and I think we all share that feeling. So thank you very much. Thank you. On a different note, I was showing a party of people around my house, which is sort of visited by various societies and organizations. And one lady detached herself from the group. The group went off into one of the other rooms, and she came up to me, and she said that in the 1970s, there was this German author called Hochhut who wrote a play about the death of Sikorsky and implied that it was the doing of the British government. She said that she was a civil servant at that time, and she was involved in defending the position of the British government. And she saw all the documents. Those documents exist. And she said it was not the Russians who did it. It was not the Americans, it was not the Germans. It was the British. So that's a story that's yet to come out. Mm-hmm. And with your authority and your vast experience, I think if you're the man who could get those documents out. You got them out of Serbia, post-Soviet Russia. You can get them out of Boris Johnson. But I'm sure that's true. Also, the other point I wanted to make is, yes, as Anna said a moment ago, it's people closing ranks and the establishment protecting itself. But I haven't been a whistleblower, but I've been a dissident in a certain organisation, several organisations in my life, and what I've learned is that, yes, the establishment does close ranks, but there's also a secret hierarchy. And in the case, in this case, I can assure you that there was Soviet influence in everything that happened. And that one of the people pulling the strings on what Toby Lowe did, Lord Alderton, was Smirsch or Gru or whatever you want. It only takes one person to do it. That's what we're up against. It's not just the establishment trying to protect itself and calling in the help of their chums. There are much deeper forces at work. Same with Sikorsky, the same with the people that you wrote about, and your own experience proves it. And I'm sure you've had this thought on many occasions yourself. That's it.
Thank you. Now, please go up to the microphone. Very well. Yeah. We'll just try again.
My name's Alan Jones, and Count Tolstoy, I remember as vividly as you do, our appearance in 1994 in the last of the cases you mentioned. I want to put to you two questions. One of them is the question I remember putting to you all those years ago. And I've read your book, of course, it's completely compelling. That Macmillan was in charge, and Churchill and Alexander were opposed to this. What, first question is, what was Macmillan's motive for a crime of this magnitude? And the second question I want to ask you, and in fact I raised it with you, I think briefly in correspondence last week, is nobody has ever disputed the contents of victims of the yacht that I'm aware of. It was very favourably reviewed at the time. It hasn't been contradicted. And yet I notice when I dip into standard histories, the Second World War, Andrew Roberts, who's written very favourably about you, as we know, the dust sheet of your book, Max Hastings, a number of other people who write books from the Second World War, which I consult, say virtually nothing about the repatriation of 2 million people in Yalta. I would very much like to hear what your theory is about why it hasn't entered the mainstream British public informed historical consciousness. The first question, Millen's motive. Second, why are we still so ignorant about the contents of victims of Yalta?
Yes. Well, it's very nice to see you here, Alan, after all. Our battle in that secret courtroom, and here Alan Jones was a very great, very distinguished lawyer, but also a great support. Macmillan's motive, in my book I say in passing that I say what he did and could be proved to have done and said and written, but what I don't do is put the motive. Well, the first reason is I don't know the motive. But as Sherlock Holmes once said, you know, when you've eliminated the impossible, you're left with what actually happened, something to that effect. None of the reasons that have been given on Macmillan's behalf can stand up for a minute now. We know far too much. He says, oh, we got back British prisoners in exchange. But he also did worse things because he lied and said that Alexander had sent him to Austria to sort things out. But Alexander didn't. I quote all the telegrams and exchanges going on. It's just not true. And I don't know what Max Hastings is. He's been rather a supporter of the government in this. Andrew Roberts is much more forthright. But, Alan's saying, my guess, and obviously after having read so much, I must have a guess. Well, there are only two possibilities. I think it's almost inexplicable unless the Soviets had some hold on him. And they were desperate to get a hold. I mean, there's an amusing example when Field Marshal Alexander flew up soon after the German surrender. He met
his opposite number, Marshal Tolbukhin of the Soviet Army, and but they had a friendly conversation, and then Tolbukhin's aide showed him to where he was to sleep in a house in the village where they met. And as Alexander was about to, he found a camp bed, he was quite happy, he was about to start undressing, suddenly he sort of looked around and he saw a very attractive young lady in Red Army uniform unfolding a camp bed in his bedroom. He said, "What are you doing here?" And she said, "Well, I'm your bodyguard." Well, Alexander, who'd fought with the Welsh Guards through the Great War and was probably one of the toughest and bravest soldiers in the British Army, smiled and said, "Well, thank you, my dear, but I don't think I need a bodyguard." Well, of course, we all know what the bodyguard was there for. Macmillan was the first leading politician, British politician, to visit the Soviet Union in the early 30s. And at one point he comments on the extremely attractive in-tourist girl who showed him around. I think it was Kiev, I can't remember. Well, those in-tourist girls, were 100% recruited or acting for the NKVD. But why should he have been... I mean, guessing, of course I am. What hold would they have on him? Well, there are two aspects to this. The first is, I would suspect it's something quite squalid and ordinary, you know, which people, especially in those days, would have been unpleasant to have revealed. And again, purely guessing, I'm not being sarcastic, I am guessing. He left Eton under very suspicious, well, cloudy circumstances, which were never explained after 2 years. He would never wear an old Etonian tie or go to any old... He loved anything like that where he could parade himself. Or there's the lady in question. Or there's even, which now we would rather sympathise with him, which he obviously wouldn't have wanted known, which was his wife's long-standing infidelity with Bob Boothby. I met Boothby and we chatted about this, he's a merry old soul, rather dishonest. And he said, "Well, all I can say is that nothing that I've read in your book about Macmillan surprises me." But really, it may never be known, frustratingly. What we do know is what he did, and what we do know is that it was what he said he claimed to have done and why are lies and can be proved to be lies. But otherwise... it's a tantalising mystery. But I think, first of all, people have got to be allowed to make up their minds about what happened, what Macmillan did, and then the question of motive, in a way it's more important, but it's secondary, and I don't know the answer yet. But what was your other question, Alan?
Why has the septic pastoral victims of Yalta
and the refugees, yes,
over 2 million people, not become more widely understood in public and in standard histories of the
world? I put some of that down to the disinformation of the people who were trying to shut me up, because their argument was that this is discreditable to Britain. But my answer is, if you read my books, you can see it's not discreditable to Britain for the very simple reason that nobody in Britain knew anything about it. They didn't know even at the time or even for many years afterwards until Nicholas Bethel's book appeared, and then mine. So, and I do think too that the gentleman before raised an interesting point about this knee-jerk reaction, especially among old soldiers. But I have noticed one particular thing, and that is, if there are old soldiers who were actually there, and I interviewed scores of them, they think it was a disgraceful, horrible operation. And as Reverend Kenneth Tyson, the chaplain to the Argylls, who had the worst job, which in the camp at the Ents, said he had afterwards. They were tough people. They'd fought the private soldiers. They'd fought all the way up through North Africa and Italy, and probably, he said, many of them before the war belonged to Glasgow razor gangs. But he said they came to me weeping and said, "This isn't what we fought the war for, sir." And that's what so many said. There's a huge difference between the people who were there and people who weren't there.
I have in the past, they're all getting old or dead now, met soldiers who say, no, it's disgraceful, you're slurring the British Army. On the contrary, my books, well, I just say what the evidence shows. What the evidence shows is that it is not a slur on the British Army. British Army hated that. They who were involved hated what they were doing. The most important members of the British Army, people like Field Marshal Alexander, General McCreary, the commander of 8th Army, were men of impeccable honour who were deceived throughout, lied to, and were horrified when they discovered what had happened. So I think the knee-jerk reaction is disappointing and foolish, but I suppose that generation is dying out anyway. But as I say, I mean, there's a book called by a former Tory MP who'd been a soldier in the war. I've gone and forgotten his name momentarily. And he starts it by a preface where he said, I write as an eyewitness of these events. But a bit of investigation showed that he was never anywhere near Austria at that time. And so it's a whole farrago of invented things. The main one being that he said, he used some very quaint phrase, that the Austria at that time was a complete colander of people milling around, totally uncontrollable, and there was nothing else to be done but hand them over to the Soviets. Well, as I've explained for the first time in this book, on the contrary. And actually, Nigel Nicholson, who was a witness in our trial and an intelligence officer in the Guards Brigade, said that he wrote a letter to me. He said it is ridiculous to say that we couldn't control them. They were all happy to be prisoners, Germans as well as Cossacks, and we got on very well with them. We were very friendly with them. It's people who weren't there who suddenly think, oh dear, the army's reputation is slurred. The best, if something bad's happened, the best thing to do is to make it public, condemn the people who are guilty, not just all. And praise the people who are innocent. But they all act as individuals in different ways. One of the things I think, as an historian, is you must let all these different voices speak. Some people weren't guilty of anything who were there. Some were more guilty. Some were very guilty, like Aldington and Keatley. But everyone is different. They're human beings. So it's, yes, that's what I feel.
One last question, please. There was somebody over there. Yes.
Yes, you've given us an absolutely wonderful evening, and whatever else happens, you, in history, will be vindicated because you did tell the truth and you told it very courageously. I just find it immensely inspiring listening to you. I don't think I'm alone. Lord Aldington will now have met a rather higher judge. You can't libel the dead, so surely it's perfectly safe to say everything about him and the dreadful way he behaved. As I understand the law, you cannot libel the dead. He's gone to be judged.
Well, there's someone here much better qualified than me to explain.
He died, and when he did die, I can remember reading all the obituaries, and the one thing for which he became famous was all that had been revealed about him. So that seemed to me quite clear. And I do think, actually, that history will record what really happened. I think that's increasingly happening, and I think, in a strange way, some of the younger Polish people now settling in Britain and having their children at school and so on are helping to make sure a more balanced version of the Second World War is taught. It happens that way in the public. I'm speaking as a journalist and as an historian, although not a very distinguished one myself. Which brings me to the other point. I'm doing some work on the story of Sue Ryder, Baroness Ryder of Warsaw. As a young woman working in Britain, looking after people who had been prisoners of war, she knew, they knew, these were people in Britain, that they were going to be sent to the Soviet Union. And she had the ghastly experience, which she describes in her book, of encountering dead bodies hanging in the washroom where Soviet prisoners of war had been. They hanged themselves rather than be sent back. And she helped to try to smuggle some of them, only a handful, she was just one young woman, away, giving them false identities, including the translator who was telling her what was going on and asking could she do anything. She was a young woman in her 20s and couldn't. So she knew, Have you got any comment on that? I wonder if there's a whole story about that. This was happening in Britain. I just wondered if you could add something more about that.
I met Sue Ryder when I was writing the book, and she was a brave woman. I think that... yes, well, George Orwell made the same point. This was in 1945. Why are newspapers entirely silent? Well, then it's understandable. They were still sucking up to the Soviets and influenced by wartime propaganda. So they didn't want it known. But I think it's a bad thing in a private person or in a whole country where you can't admit to your bad things and just say everything you do is perfect, especially when it's something as atrocious as this. And the important thing is, anyway, is to identify the people by spreading the guilt, saying it was all British, supported by Britain, which isn't true. That lets off the guilty people. They should be identified. And the only way we can do it now, which is the way I think in the long term that actually matters, is by writing accurate history. Why, as Alan Jones said, why people like Max Hastings ignore this, and I've noticed it too. You can read the history, and if it's there at all, it's a tiny, tiny footnote, and almost certainly with the grotesque error of fact even got into one paragraph. So,
very well. Thank you very much for the questions. Thank you very much, Count Nikolai Tolstoy. Very well.
Can you hear me?
Yes, but it's better if you come over. Is it a short statement, please?
Relevant to our discussion. My name is Michael Kulchikovsky. I am a former employee of the British government, the German government, and for a long time, the Saudi Arabian government. In the 50s, I was a very active member of the Polish Scout movement. And I remember taking part in the great march of Polish Boy Scouts, about 400 or 500 of us. We marched from Whitehall, from Hyde Park to Whitehall, concerning the visit of Bulganin and Khrushchev. And when we gathered near Hyde Park, we were all in Polish scout uniform, and some people had prepared little banners or signs pointing to Stalin's crimes. And a number of officers, an inspector, I remember, from the British police, came and looked at them and said, "You can't take those." And I remember to this day that one of them was about Vorkuta, the prison in the Arctic, where so many people died under Stalin. Katyn was referred to, and also a rather peculiar sign which said, "The crime on the River Drava." And that time it didn't mean much to me, but when I got home, I looked up the River Drava, which is a river and its valley in North Croatia on the border with Austria. And I, like the speaker, was interested in history and did a great lot of reading in my teens. And I then read a Polish weekly newspaper, which was a very serious one, founded in Poland in the 1920s, Wiadomości Polskie. And there were a number of articles about the murder of the Cossacks and various Polish-Russian officers in the valley of the River Drava. And this was in the second half of the 50s. And it caused a great stir in the Polish community. I think most people have since died and don't really remember it. But I think it was possibly the first attempt to write something about what happened with the Cossacks and the Russian officers were there.
Thank you.
And I think it's interesting to note it was in the second half of the 50s that these articles appeared. I believe in my loft, in my house, I still have copies of Wiadomości for those years. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I would like to say now that the discussion can carry on, obviously, in the foyer, where there's an opportunity to purchase the books by Count Nikolai Tolstoy, and even the internet people are also interested in being able to purchase them. Moreover, I would like to, of course, thank once again Count Nikolai Tolstoy for coming, and I do hope everyone will come for further discussion and opportunity also to see Count Nikolai Tolstoy's book. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.